And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. There are four interviews tonight. Let me just get those up for you so that I can tell you what's coming up. It's in 2 hours, it'll be the Black Horse, and then Jeff Younger, and then Tukey. So it's a full roster, the first one this year. But first, it's Gran Torino. This is someone that I should have had on years ago, and I feel bad that I never invited him. I don't know why. You're muted. You're muted, I should say. There we go.
I was just saying you should feel terrible. Go on, go ahead.
I do. I apologize. And I honestly don't have any good reason why I didn't invite you on until now. So I apologize. Nice. But now that you're here, could you introduce yourself just for the sake of anyone who doesn't know who you are?
I'm Ron Croft, working under the pseudonym of Gran Torino, being streaming, being Irish content creator. Had the account since 2008, but did my first broadcasting in around 2015, maybe a little bit before, in relation to FGM, kind of just throwing a critical eye on what was happening here in Ireland. I was saying to Colin earlier on, just before we started the stream, that we might kind of go back to my timeline and my inception point into coming into all of this, and it kind of ties into kind of where we all are in this situation all around in Europe, especially in the gameplay that's unrolling out. All of us that have been paying attention, and I'll speak and I'll preface it as well, Colin, that we'll assume that all our audience members are not NPCs anyway, that's for sure, because they wouldn't be tuning in on that case. But we're kind of on the existential crisis that we're all facing, and the civilizational change that is occurring right now, the manufactured consent. Or I heard another one thing was assimilation, ubiquitous assimilation or something like this. Kind of this assimilation that they're forcing on us through the propaganda of media and social networks, and how it's all come to play over the last couple of decades. And each and one of us in our own different timelines have become aware of this now, and where we are now.
Yeah, and I think that Ireland is a very good case study for this, a very good example of this, because until what the 90s, it was a very traditional society. And I think there was probably some people who thought it was backward or primitive, who were embarrassed, who wanted to get with the program, get hip, get modern. But nowadays it just seems idyllic. It just seems like a lost paradise almost. When you see photos of Ireland from the 80s and 90s, it just seems lovely. So if we start there, that presumably is the world that you grew up into. Yeah. And could you describe it so that people know what has been lost?
Yeah, that's a great starting point. When I think back to my earliest memories, and when I think now of Paradise Lost, as you say, the homogeneity, the social cohesion that I grew up in, though there were desperate times. Like, I'm coming in around from the 70s. I'm born in 1970, so the Christmas these times of year at this time was always idyllic. We were all tuned in to the Late Late Show. That's Carcass is still broadcasted every year. It's great fanfare. But at the time, it was in our innocence, I suppose, in our naivety, this nation that had forged itself out of the Declaration of April 24, 1916, and then in that short decade that preceded that, less than 8 years, we had the creation of the Free State in 1922. And then under our own design, from the earliest inception, I was talking about the books at the background there with yourself, Dermot Ferrer, as a Nation Not a Rabble, I often refer to it as well, is the narrated, he breaks it down into three timelines, the written historical events as the people that wanted to frame the truth, or the historical events as they wanted it, the actual eyes on the ground and people that were left behind, or the forgotten voices that weren't spoken about other than the likes of Collins and all of that in that time, and the leaders that were portrayed and put out, like the barristers of the time, the elites of that time, you know. And then through the 30 or 40 years that followed, it was a desperate state to try and get the economy of the Free State rolling and get it rolling. It was still very much reliant on the empire, you know, still it had ties in with the crown and stuff and all of that. So I think it was only about the 60s or the 70s when modern age modernity started to kick in. Industries really came online. Our dairy, our farming has always been the bulwark of the economy from the start. You know, farmers were it all. And that ties in, as you said, when I'm traveling around in that time in the 70s and 80s, what a distance takes now, 20 or 30 minutes, could take half a day back in those days in that roads, because there was no motorways. There's little side roads. There's the little roads that you imagine when you travel further into rural Ireland that still exist, but that was the mainstay in Dublin, not the colossus, that it's becoming now, and it's on the way to becoming. So there was these fantastic journeys with the families, and, you know, a little trip up to the cousins or family members would take a considerable concerted effort to get there and manage it back. You know, there was no car seat belts. There was none of this thing. I remember my dad driving back, probably one or two in, and my mother and father laughing, and the three of us in the background. To go from that idea then to, you know, as I got older, coming into my teens, it was desperate. Not poverty per se is what we talk about from the grandparents, but like in the 80s and all that, it was desperate times in Ireland. There was economic stagnation. Work was very sparse on the ground. You know, you'd have to get on into working with the state to get any sort of meaningful income and stuff like that. So tough times, but I remember myself just the classroom full of all the different personalities that were there. And I think even in the inception, in my class at that time, there was a young fella in there, a coloured fella as well, Justin. And I remember Avid, he was the only one of his type as well, but he just wasn't treated any differently. But very much the epithetical stereotype that it turned out to be, you know, from that point. But to that now, to flip it out, where in Ireland, in some classes, you could have only two or three faces that look like me and everybody else looks like Justin now, is the complete capitulation and the demographics changed. That is not becoming apparent now. It's presenting and has done in the classrooms, because that's where it's most notable. You'll see it in the yearbooks. And myself and Gemma O'Doherty, when we were first streaming, before in the 2015, 2016, after the election and stuff like that, Gemma put up a post talking about the demographic change that was apparent in the classrooms then, and she was lambasted for it. I'm sure it made international news and stuff. But she's a very
this is a very important thing, because what deniers of the Great Replacement often say is they'll point to the general population percentages, yeah, and they'll say that, you know, Britain today is still 80% white or something. Yeah. You've got to look at the under 20s, so the kids, because the demographics there are obviously going to define the demographics in the future. So it's such a deceptive, deceitful thing to do, to talk about the general population. So sorry to interrupt you there.
Not at all. No, it's a well-old playbook. It's statistical lies through statistics and, you know, aversion and preying on people's, I don't know, ineptitude or callous nature. Well, they're all being, as we've understood, being placated by the bread and circuses and the distractions and training the mind, like for TikTok, for the attention span to be sparse, ever dwindling down to now 30 seconds that it is. Nobody can do long form anything anymore, you know. But and I will interject at this point as well that I'm very enthused now, also now with the younger generation coming in now from like the alphas and the zoomers, because of when I look at the Nick Fuentes arc now, his journey arc now, and the reversal of his timeline, that American culture of the zoomers and the alphas now behind them, who are very well aware, that's here in Ireland as well. I see that sparsely, that drip effect. I'm sure you'll see that in the UK. You got, yeah, young Bob over there, speaker Bob, young Bob that goes around now, 17-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, very, yeah.
Fantastic. But
before we get to that, though, let's stick to the chronology, because I want to take it one step at a time. So the 80s, there was economic stagnation. I mean, Britain was like that as well, Scotland and England. And then in the 90s, what would you say about the 90s in Ireland?
Yeah, thanks for reining me in there. I'll ping off. You'll have to rein me in and keep me on track as well, Colin. Because I'll go
off. That's my job.
Yeah. The '90s for me. Well, most of you wouldn't be aware, but over here, I joined the army, the British Army, in 91. I left home. I was in my timeline and the chronology. I was kind of getting to you. I entered the workforce at 14 with my father and went into full employment on the ferries. And became was a galley boy on the ships and the ferries there. So I was in working life at 14. Most of my predecessors would have been introduced into the workforce at that time as well. And I had an inkling to go to the Irish Navy. I wanted to join the Irish Navy because I was doing my deckhand. I was becoming a certified deckhand, you know, to steer the ship, do the ropes, all that jazz. And it was virtually impossible to get into the Irish Navy. We only had one, like we still did, it's desperate now, but one or two ships at the time. And being in the scouts as a younger fella as well, having avoided all the treachery of what happened in the church also happened in the scouts over here as well. Managed to avoid all of that pretty much in the school system as well, which ties in with the murder machine that's going on with us all. But then in the leading up to the 90s, I haven't entered the workforce as well. I was jobless at 18, kind of left the Emerald Isle here and went across to our neighbours over to the UK in Swansea, of all places. I landed there. And that was because I was working on a ship in the Swansea Cork Ferry with my father at the time. And we said, stay there. And here's a month's rent. Get on with it. And that's what happened. But I ended up homeless there. So I was homeless in Swansea for about a year before a charity came and, you know, helped me out with that situation. But in the meantime, I had signed on for the army to get off the streets, essentially. I was homeless. And I couldn't go back. There was nothing to go back to, you know. So after nigh on a year of security clearances, I got called up and I went down there, and it was the change in it for me, because it was the making of me then. Even though I was able to get through the hardship of the homelessness and the hardship of the working life and stuff like that, it was the army that brought me in and kind of fashioned me to be what I'd say to make them was the makings of me. And I had to take care of myself, I had to act like accordingly, leadership roles. And the first Gulf War just finished. So we were kind of in preparation for what they knew was going to be the second Gulf War as well. But I'd left on that timeline. But in that time, I was stationed out in Germany in the early 90s. And I remember distinctly the influx of all the Turks coming into Germany at the time. And how after a period of time, there was 5 million or so, they became a voter bloc in Germany. And we're talking 92, 93, 94, but when the currency was still the Deutschmark. And I was being paid in sterling, so there was a 2-to-1 ratio there. You know, there was the exchange rate. So it was a fabulous time. Germany was a completely different place as Ireland was back in that timeline that I'm trying to say to you. And that was fairly, you know, it was huge because it's a huge geography. But I was Iserlohn near Dortmund. And again, very homogenous situation. But when you could see on their national TV, the Turks fighting on the streets, it was mostly because of those new immigration. When the voting came in, it was always seen that they were a huge voter bloc. So I'd witnessed that, having stationed there in 3 years, and then came back to the UK, was stationed down near Salisbury Plain there at the army training ground. And it was then that I'd started notice that the change in Wiltshire, when I was down based down near Wiltshire in Salisbury, going out in the nightlife down there, and more and more of different people were being, you know, it was coming up. It was always a multicultural society anyway, Britain, more so because of the 70s and the 80s and the different influx that you had there. But there was more and more seen to be, up until a point where I was attacked on Paddy's Day, just being walking out in the street and got bottled from behind just because it was different. But you could feel the tension in the air in, where am I thinking there now, 2008, 2010, just before they're in around the crash. Am I right? Yeah. Oh, a little bit before.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
when I came back to Ireland. And that's when I noticed the same sort of pattern happened in Germany, happening in the UK. And in Ireland, we're still spared of it. We hadn't had that much of it. That's when I said, I've seen this and I can see this pattern repeating because direct provisions were starting. And that's when I started to broadcast on YouTube because I picked up on an American thing, the Q stuff had kicked off. That's what first kind of drew me into that as well, you know. I don't know if you knew that. So I went through the whole Q understanding.
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah, no, it was Patriot Soapbox was the thing that was kicking around at the time. And if you look back on any of the earlier streams, that was all part of that there. So pretty much everything that came in and around that has been playing out, but no longer, not that I'm saying not trust the plan, but there's bigger things going on here. That's me. Apologies for that. There's bigger things going on, you know. So the recognition, the pattern recognition that I got through my travels and through my timeline, Laura led me back here to Ireland and noticing that the influx of asylum seekers at the Breck Provision Centres was increasing and that there was a plan. And also because of my collaboration on the American culture side of things, knew that politics was downstream of culture, and that it was important because of reading with Andrew Breitbart's book to engage with social media, to engage and push back, to be that voice. And hence I said, I'm just going to go up and speak of it, because as circumstances have it, I was by myself. I didn't have I was separated from my children, so there was no personalities. They were kind of walled up, and I kind of knew what was at stake as well. You know, you'd be the first to speak out. I was in contact with Tommy Robson back in the early days, only briefly and stuff like that. You kind of knew the circles that we were kind of traveling around. When we first met many moons ago for a brief period of time back then, that day. And again, because of the fracture that the left like to do and put that distrust, it was very much a two-way thing. As you said, it began to apologize for that. We kind of drifted on because back here, the left philosophy is deeply embedded, and they have that playbook of infiltration, labeling, besmirching, and delegitimizing as much as possible through lies and deception. And that kind of, I was an early adapter. I couldn't figure all that kind of stuff out, you know, till we get used to the playbook, and we've all overcome it. As I say, Nick Ferrandis, who cares? Call me racist, whatever you want. That's where we all should be at.
Well, and there does seem to be, specifically in Ireland, there, it's an amazing process that's happened there. And part of it seems to be a set of techniques for dealing with people who complain, people like yourself, a set of techniques for infiltrating them, for demonizing them, shaming them, and really silencing them. And it's really astonishing to see. And the sheer speed of the change in Ireland is amazing. And I was, as we met in 2017, I think it was, and 2019. But I was in Dublin in 2017, and for a conference, and so I saw it then. I didn't see it 2 years later, but I saw it then. And even then, there was a sense of it. You could there were non-Irish people there. There were foreigners there. But from what I hear, it's just that population has just ballooned since 2017, and now Dublin is almost a foreign city. I mean, that seems to be what happens to large cities. They become global cities. Like, I can remember Amsterdam in the early, I think, 2001, just before 9/11. I went there, and so I saw Amsterdam then, and I saw it much later, 2017, and God, it had transformed, you know. And I think the same must be happening everywhere. You mentioned Germany in the early 90s, and oddly enough, I have a memory of that as well, because I think in 93, I went on my family went on a trip, a bus trip to Legoland in Denmark, and we went through Germany, and we stopped at Hamburg for a few hours. So I saw Hamburg in 1993, and it was a sunny day. It was a really hot summer's day. And all I remember is that it was entirely white people. It was entirely Germans and other European tourists. All of these, and you know, now it seems incredible. And of course, Copenhagen, Denmark, was entirely white as well. Mm-hmm. And it just seems incredible now to think that well within living memory, yours and mine, this was what Europe was like. And especially Ireland. So that's my interjection got over. I just wanted to say that.
No, yeah, well, it is starting. And as you say, Ireland is a kind of a test bed because we are such a small landmass, 200 by 300 miles. Any sort of noticeable change like this is startling and stark, and it happens quite quickly. There's not the slow drip that the United States would got, even because that's a colossal state. And then even the United Kingdom, it's still a huge place. And when you travel around it, you know, you can see the kind of the changes. I remember, like, when Tommy's talking about him growing up in Luton and stuff like that, I was Milton Keynes, and I traveled through even that short period of time that I was living in Milton Keynes, and I was driving trucks at the time for one of the major supermarkets, and I'd have to often go into London, into Luton and stuff like that. And even in those short journeys, and that would have been in like 98, 99, coming up to the millennium or after that, I would drive up as far as north to the bigger mountains, and there was whispers of what was going on up then, even back then, in relation to the grooming gangs and stuff like that. And that was very startling. I mean, that was the kind of information that I brought back that I could understand with the different types of migration that was coming, because the numbers of the Islamic faith that were coming in was kind of minimal as well as such. It was more so more Europeans. It was the Polish incursion firstly, and it was sought as the example because it was an economic benefit. Poles came, they worked hard, and they had a strong work ethos and a nationalism, and they wanted to not to assimilate, but to respect the host nation to where they were, because it gave them an opportunity, because they were getting paid in zlotys at the time. But funny enough, it was because of that ruling that I'd had an even earlier taste of the economic disadvantage of multiculturalism, because I was working on that Swansea Cork ferry, which was one of the first ferries to take advantage of a foreign workforce. And they would have a Greek crew for 6 months of the year and a Polish crew for the other 6 months of the year. But they would pay them half the wages of an Irish crew that they would have had to pay. So that was the first inception that I got it, because I at that time was... The reason that I left that, I was the only Irish crew member that was working that was employed by the Greek company, because my father was at the time was an onboard manager, and he was quite pally with the people. So it was owned by Onassis, the big shipping magnate. He supplied the crew and the captain. So anyway, it was a bit of something happened on the ship. He decided to let me go. And that's how my story progressed into moving into Swansea. But what I'm saying is that was that first taste of what happens is the driving down of wages, you know, this mass influx of people that are coming in, it's going to saturate in the labour market. It's increasing the profit for the corporations as such. And in Ireland, that's now very much the case now, where jobs are becoming very scarce. The housing crisis, which is compounded by the migration, which is never being talked about till Irish nationalists brought it to the fore. And we kept speaking. And because we've mastered social media, we have huge voices on social media in Ireland. And we've got a plethora now of citizen journalists after the fray. Everybody's got a phone now, and more people are emboldened to speak out over here or to Ireland. So that talk of the darker effects of the economic or the migration that was coming in. But it was to the break to debut, the hardest part of, even though we managed, we got, like I said, I want to shout out to Mick O'Keefe, who's in contact with Elon Musk on Twitter. He's one of the state's main agitators over there, because he's so big. And other accounts now that we are, as nationalist media influencers like Philip O'Dwyer and John and all the other people that have been speaking out and constantly driving at it, that the TikTok influencers can no longer be ignored and are now speaking on about the as I said in my last TikTok, the retardation in Ireland that's happening now because of the drop in IQ levels. And again, you won't see that in the mainstream level, but because we've allowed people to come over here that don't have to abide by the rules of the road, don't have to have insurance, don't have to have tax. It's the Wild West. But because they've allowed so many people in and given them access to roads, our motorway, our main thoroughfare, the M50, has now officially been deemed full. The people that contract are saying that the M50 is full. We can't take any more traffic that's coming through. But correlation, causation and all of this kind of stuff seems to be lost. They won't touch that because of the amount of population growth which they see, which the Irish government has said is a net positive. Because of our stewardship, we've had a huge population growth and a thriving economy, and our GDP figures have never been stronger than before, you know. And it's framed that way. It's the gaslighting constantly. It's not the after effects. We've no infrastructure. Our water systems are deluged. Our drain, our sewer systems are as 18th century still, haven't been brought up to date, you know what I mean? Fanciful figures of money, Irish money being spent. The children's hospital is still being built £2.5 billion later, having been initially quoted at 989 million at a cost of just under 1,000 meter square per meter square. It's now running at 8,000 meter square, and it still isn't finished, still isn't completion, and there's still a lot of work to go on, you know?
So it's this is the sort of festering truth underneath the shiny surface of multiculturalism. What you actually have is lots of dysfunction and things taking ages to happen that shouldn't, that should be quite. I mean, how it's we've built hospitals for a very long time. We know how to do it. It's not rocket science. You know? Yeah. We should be able to do something like that. And yet a project like that just drags on and on and on and costing God knows how much. I mean, there are similar things in Britain. But one thing that I wanted to ask you about is, what can you remember roughly when you first heard about the asylum hotels? Because it seems to me that that's something that started in Ireland before becoming a thing in Britain.
I interviewed the originator. I'm going to go up to my channel here and just go through some of the, I'll bring up the earlier, just for a timeline to remind me. But I did the initial interview with Brian Flanagan, who was one of the founders of the Irish Refugee Council of Ireland at the time. And it was a well-intended system that they wanted to bring in. It was prior to NGOs, and people were coming to the country at that time. Many people coming, and throughout all the time, as they have done, and come here to study in small numbers. When you know, and then romantic relationships have happened, and people are here, and there's always been a splash of people. But that was because, as I said to a friend of mine recently, because it was difficult to get here at the time from afar, you know. But because of globalization, now it's now for cheaper traveling like that. But at the time, his counsel would have a rejection rate. There was only retired judges that would adjudicate on the applications from each claimant. And they were saying at the time, I think there was only 6 retired judges that were doing it. They were having a refusal rate of 85% at that time. It was, even at that time, it was the amount of fraudulence that they wouldn't even pass them off. But then the NGO class started to emerge. I don't rightly remember that timeline or how they came about, but they removed Brian from his position. They ousted him and managed to take over the Irish Refugee Council. And then it sort of evolved from there, from them taking over the as being the mouthpieces for the government and for the provision centres, as they kind of call them now. The first big one we had then was it used to be a holiday home called Mosny on the north side of Dublin, which was a huge, it was outside, it was beside the beach, like, and you know Ireland, it wasn't like Miami or anything like that, where you'd be dancing around in your pajamas. It'd be like Scotland, you know, you could see it. And if you went out there in your bathing suit, you'd be blue before you knew it. But that was our holidays, and it was pissing rain. And if you got a dry hour when you were all out, you were able to go to the carnival, where the mechanical carnivals. But that was where the majority of Irish people used to go throughout the 70s and the 80s, I believe, maybe the 80s and the 90s. And it was all we could afford at the time. But it was ours, you know what I mean? It was fantastic memories then. But then that was taken over and became a direct provision centre for thousands, for I think it was 1,000 or 2,000 at the time, because there was an influx. It slowly started to creep. I suppose the George Soros effect had started to kick in, and people were being directed and pushed towards the European nations. You know, it was starting to fill up. So it was in and around, for me, coming back, I suppose, 95, 96, when I came back from my travels away, and started to understand what Mosny had become, and that there was small little hotels starting to be taken over. And through my contact with the Q side of things, and the fabulous contacts that I'd made throughout the States, all the great friends that I made through that journey as well, and another journey of awakening, you know, about MK Ultra, all that kind of jazz that I came to understand, and how that played out, how that ties in with propaganda and Mercus and all that Breitbart spoke about, propagandizing the people and stuff, blah blah blah. But Ireland's creeped down to direct provision centers. Then it became that, well, we can't hold this amount of people. It went from 2,000 to 6,000, and people were starting to bed share and stuff like that. So they created that, as they have done now, this Hegelian now, where it's this small situation where it's, once this Pandora box is opened of migration, is that it seems to unfold and get worse and worse. Something seems, there's too many people there. We need to come up with something, situation. Oh, I know, let's start hiring out hotels. Let's start, you know, giving them access to the welfare, more access to the welfare system. Maybe let them start to work there as well. Up until the point now where in the last local elections, which I took part in as well, the last local elections, because, you know, we needed to throw hats in the ring for representation, and the people voted at the time. But what I'm saying is that the refugees were down are now being given access to vote, which is the game plan, as what's happening in the UK and how we're here, is get as many excess voters in now to keep themselves in power.
Yeah, and this is something that I find absolutely disgusting, because it means that a country just becomes whoever happens to be there at the time. Resident. Rather, so Ireland is just that, rather than the Irish people who have a special privilege and a right to control the politics of their country. Well, now someone who's just shown up, who's just arrived, has that right as well. And I think that's outrageous.
Absolutely. And again, the
it's this detachment of a people from a land.
People, I hear at the moment, Ireland people say, don't seem to react to that. The civic nationalism is lost on the most people. They don't understand the privilege it is to be able to vote, but the privilege that was afforded to us by like, as I said, from the creation of the state in 22 and all the way up there, and the blood that failed to get that state, to break away from the British Empire at the time, you know, and to create that, and the blood that was built, and the generations that went through poverty to make sure that the next generation had it a little bit easier than that, to up until now, where an Irish passport is nothing more than a comic book, and everything that we held true. It's only happening in these, more so since the pandemic, since 2019, since the allowance of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians to come in, because, you know, we must stand and show our support for the Banderites. The slow gradual change from citizens' rights being superseded by refugees' rights now, as to where we are now, where they can't be detained and arrested or questioned on anything, even though as what's happening in the UK is happening here as well. But women now cannot walk the streets. Men cannot walk the streets. Everybody is underage. Again, falling into the Hegelian of bringing in utter chaos till we scream out for whatever solution, which is supposed to be the digital IT. But again, that has been Ireland's slow drip of the direct provision centres. And then when I start broadcasting on it and bringing more attention to it, I seen in Ross Lair, again, going to one of my previous streams, Ross Lair is one of the main points from France, from Le Havre to France, would be a main cargo route for trucks, stuff like that. And that was the Ross Lair Harbour Hotel was stationed there. And that was one of the bigger ones that was starting to be taken over. And they were trying to run it as a 50-50 enterprise, half a hotel and half a migrant center at the early days. And there was weddings being held. And then there was 30. And they did have sometimes the majority women and children in them places to placate, because the likes of myself were going down with our YouTube channels and filming outside or attending the meetings with locals as we did in the hotel, capturing on camera Garrod, who we'll speak of. Garrod was part of that as well. He brought his YouTube channel back in the early days. And we would attend the local meetings. And they didn't know what to do with us because we were outside meeting. We had microphones, we had a camera, and we had a live stream audience. And nobody knew what to do with us, you know. RT wouldn't come up and show us. But some of the locals could see the benefit of what was happening on social media at that time, because there was no TikTok, no political TikTok, no political as much as YouTube. So we started bringing microphones and cameras in on stabilizers, as Phil and the rest of the gang did, and started upsetting the apple cart there, you know, by driving another narrative. So, again, this has been this desperately slow, achingly slow awakening now to where we can now quantify our numbers in over here in the Republic of, say, up to 200,000. There's been, on the last election there with the spoiled, when the government asked us to vote on the president's election, and the People's Choice wasn't allowed to even run, because they had... What some have now in a court case going through the courts now was an illegal maneuver by using the party whip to say that no TD can elect an independent or outside the party's representatives, i.e. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, or Sinn Féin. And there's a case going through that now to say that was an illegal move, that the whip cannot be used on a presidential election. It can be used in other, like for bills and other working functionaries of the parliament. But not in this case. That's another thing that's playing on in the background. We're trying in our own way to bring legal cases forward to try and slow the beast down, to try and expose it a little bit more. We're trying to always be talking about the excess debts and stuff like that. Ireland's excess debts now swinging in and around 25,000, like the graph.
Is this about COVID?
COVID, yeah. All right, sorry, we have to be careful.
So let me just finish about the hotels then, because to me that's... a very especially perverse thing, because it used to be that immigration was something that individuals undertook and at their own risk, at their own expense, and then they'd have to sort things out for themselves in the new country that they arrived in. And the government would be, you know, the public would complain about these people. The government would say, there's nothing we can do. Just got to keep letting the work, our hands are tied. But at least we're not helping. I mean, there was never this indication that the government were actually facilitating people coming. And so you go from that, say 30 years ago, to the situation now where the government is not only encouraging them and facilitating them to come here, but it's then accommodating them at great expense once they're here, and even funneling them, busing them, and in the dead of night, taking them to a new place. And as soon as the refugees, the asylum seekers, as soon as their feet touch the ground, like get off the bus, that's it. They're there in that town, and it's like an intractable problem that according to our current laws, there's just nothing that you can do about it. They're now here. That's it. It's as if they've been here for a thousand years. But it's this specific thing about the hotels I just find disgusting, because it's the government, well, doing everything for them, to ensure that are as many of them here as possible, and of course, the taxpayer pays for it. But you know, even if the taxpayer didn't pay for it, it would still be outrageous. I mean, even if George Soros was paying for this himself, it would still be outrageous. The fact that we are paying for our own dispossession is an extra
kick in the teeth.
Yeah, kick in the teeth on top of all of the rest of it.
Looking at it from a military point of view, Colin, you've never, as I understand, you've never had a military force attacking and having its forces paid for by the people that it's attacking. If you know what I mean. Fed and watered and come here. And even now at the stage where murders, rapes and pillaging and plundering is going on when the invaders are doing it, the refusal to even accept the basic reality of what's happening in the rise, that this is a fucking invasion and you are being invaded in its roughest sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And that it's being facilitated by your own government.
Or your own government.
It's just amazing. As I say, you couldn't make it up.
They all say, you know, an enemy can survive, or a nation can survive its enemies, but it can't survive the traitor amongst its ranks. And we're very much seeing that in all our public representatives, how they're all bought out. From Argentina, like even Javier Milei, as good as he's doing the economic front, he's still out traveling over to Israel and doing all of his things. You go to Mexico now, where you see what's going on in Mexico, and they have the same sort of problem that the rest of the world has. And I'll frame it, and I'll allude to it. You know, I won't say it outright, just for pleasant commentaries, but we have that in our situation here. Our Tánaiste is the same destination by birth, because his mother came from Israel and stuff like that. So we all have that place in there, and that's how they gain access to be that part of that population, that gain entry to the institutions, to academia, to political, and assume the very man that opened up our daughters, Alan Shatter, was the one to create citizenry, the bulk citizenry pageants that they have now, where we can do 5,000 or 6,000 at a time, dishing out passports in these ceremonies and creating these new Irish people. And then they walk out of that building straight away going, "I'm Irish," as you know, as black as the ace of spades, and still walking around going, "I'm Irish." You know, and the retardation, I'll go back to it again, is you. We know it. I'm not going to refrain, like Jared would know. You know what I mean? I love watching some of the interviews with Jared saying, "You came here to help us do what? You came here to help us do what?" I spooned myself off there again, Colin. Yeah, go back to you.
That's okay. So you mentioned COVID, and I think it's probably a good idea to ask you about your perceptions of that era and your experience of that era in Ireland. I've had other people talk about it before, but we don't need to go into the details of it at the time, but in retrospect, what would you say about COVID in Ireland?
I was screaming from the rafters. I think it was the very same reason that the channel was taken down, was because, as they said, without adjudication, was for medical misinformation. And I was aware from the early points, because I was paying attention to alternative media. I wasn't paying any attention to the drip feeding or the gaslighting that was going on. And many people around, because of our streams and the likes of Phil's and John's, because we would talk about this straight off the bat, we became aware of. I don't know. I'm trying to recall the information. Like when you're paying attention to social media, you know, like the video contents of Kerry Mullis coming up talking about the his PCR tests and stuff like that. And then, you know, like everybody became an instant chemist or a biologist or something like that. But you brushed up enough to know and understand about Koch's postulates and stuff like that, where you had to identify a pathogen or whatever like that that had to pass a certain criteria. None of that was done. I mean, for me, the earliest indicator of any sort of skepticism was, look, I think this, if you can take part in this experiment, if somebody mentions the part that you're going to take part in an experiment, I'm out. That doesn't matter what you're paying, you know. I knew straight off the bat as soon as that word was mentioned. But because of paying to alternative social or other media and taking information from other ways, sort of came to the conclusion that all was not well, you know. Dr. Malone and all them started to pop up, or Perry Corey, I can't remember the name specifically. But then our own doctors as well. I had on the stream up on 2019, Dr. Pat Morrissey, Dr. Marcus DeBruin, and all the physicians at the time that were speaking out against it. Dr. DeBruin was actually part of the government's one of the higher echelons of the government's response to it at the time, and he left because he's seen the barbarism that was happening in the care homes. And then at the time we'd seen what was happening in Italy and when they were staging mass deaths and stuff like that. So I was trying to, in my streams at that time, was to bring the information that was becoming apparent to me into where, and to try and make it apparent to other people as well. Many of my friends around me here have lost their minds, have lost their families and friends, because we were trying to say, look, we were just have a little think about this, have a little, you know, trying to be to our families and friends. And they weren't having a bar of it. And this is how the great fracture happened in this time of COVID as well, is because they pitted us against each other, the believers and the non-believers, the crazy.
Absolutely.
All of that.
That was a whole division in society that just came about then. It hadn't existed before. You hadn't had anti-vaxxers and pro-vaxxers before. And suddenly it was there. Or what was it? I can't remember the names for the epithets, but it was like COVIDians and deniers, COVID deniers. You're a COVID denier. You're a vaccine denier. You know, weird stuff. In retrospect, it all seems a bit silly and hysterical. Well, it was hysterical, but
it was the launch. It was the launch of the assault. So alternative means we were became aware of the 77 Brigade. There was reports coming out about propagandas and the way they were able to manipulate. Like, this is before when AI came in. AI back then was deep fakes. We were starting to become aware because more information was coming out that, oh, there's these videos, these are called deep fake videos, that they look so real, you won't know what they were. But it was the early introduction of AI that they were allowing us to see because of the information that was coming from the state side, because of the Epstein stuff like that. I mean, a whole different things came into place at different times that kind of worked around each other to force narratives. But I think I've often described myself at the start, and I think it might have been one of your early streams that I came across it and reminded me of how I describe myself now. I'm an accelerationist, and I don't think I've broken away from that. That's why when I say I streamed earlier right there, because I wanted to not only bring the information to it, but I wanted to accelerate the timeline to bring a measure of chaos to it. Because I've thought if we could bring the awareness to it before that they could release or strip feed their plans to us, that if more people would become aware of it, then we might be able to stem it back. But that's proven to be very difficult. But as I said to you, I was trying to make that point earlier on, that to now quantify our numbers since the recent presidential election, just 200,000 plus of people that spoiled their votes, people that are looking at alternative information and are now reacting in a group sort of sense, as I bring it back to the A Nation Not a Rabble. It was a very discombobulated society at the time that still brought about the rebellion, the revolution, or the free state, because inevitably they were brought together because of what the Patriots did in 1916 and took that stand, you know, and lost a couple of thousand in less than a week or whatever, but made that stand, and it started that schism. To that point there now, in that comparison now, is you see the likes of Coolock and the place where I ran in the local elections, where the police were, it was one of the first places that was trying to batter in a provision centre, or an iPass centre that they're called now. All men just dropped into the middle of a residential area. But the people of Coolock weren't having it. People of Coolock and most inner city spaces and working class areas, although the poverty is still real. The cohesion is still there, you know. Still a level of animosity. Nobody be taken as a fool. And you mind your P's and Q's. You know, everybody has its hierarchy in that estate. But when the state became under threat by this plantation of, I think they're looking for 600 men. And the place is riddled in asbestos, but they're still willing to put them into that place. You know what I mean? And it was on that ground that many of the different groups came together and brought legal cases. You can't put anybody in there. So it's riddled in asbestos. That's the whole, it was an ex-paint factory. So how desperate they are, that's to me, like from looking from my vantage point, saying this is how desperate they are to get male numbers in, that they'd even put them in peril into an asbestos, which leads me on to thinking that, like I said, the pandemic was a psychological assessment. It was an IQ test. They got to roll out their 77 Brigade. They got to roll out their news briefs. They got to see how people reacted. Then they could touch in on solutions. You know, it's part of that social engineering that they're still doing. And this works, that doesn't work. But and as I said to you, the bringing in there when the police rammed the people of Coolock, grandmothers, children, grandfathers, pepper sprayed, the gloves were off. People became aware. What's going on here? The guards, that another mask had been removed of the An Garda Síochán force, our police force, which we'd say would differentiate itself from the UK police force and stuff like that. But there's always been a cozy relationship with the Gardaí, you know what I mean? We look the other way on smaller offences and we can help you in other ways on other offences. But the complete inculcation now of the defence forces and the police force to the DEI, you know, diversity is our strength. It's the fascism of it now. Because they're all in lockstep now into that idea of it. I know I'm going off on a tangent again, Colin, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. But in some places, that seems to be dying down or suffering a certain lack of credibility over the last couple of years. Would you say that that's happening in Ireland, or do you think the woke DEI, diversity is our strength, is that still as strong as ever, still as firmly believed in as ever?
Very well funded, Colin. It's stupidly funded through the NGO class. It's the payoffs. It's it doesn't even matter about the number. Like people, there was a European event going on when the number 33,900 NGOs exist in Ireland for a population of 8 or 9 million. 33,000 are gone. Is everybody part of an NGO? There are some good ones in there that do it, but the bigger ones, like the Institute Against Racism, all the ones that you would know that are the grifters, all the ones that are paid out, like 4.5 billion of that economy that we now have is paid into the NGO class, which, as I've always said, and I'll repeat it again, is the government telling the government what to do, you know, what the government wants. They're paying them 4.5 million for them to come and tell us that we need to have, you know, more representation. There's too many white people in power in Ireland, you know what I mean? So it's been very well funded. It's still very well funded. The national broadcaster, having just survived, just previous to the last election, its finances were in ruins. Its credibility was lost. People weren't paying their licenses. And just before the last general election from the 33rd Dáil, which was during the pandemic, tying in with the symbology of them numbers, which was the 33rd Dáil, when they brought in the most totalitarian and draconian laws into Ireland and locked people. We'll go back on that pandemic as well, because we haven't finished on that. But they were very much a part of the system. They were bringing in that totalitarian control. And it was the first wave of assault psychologically. Let's shake the jar. Let's create the friction between the black ants and the red ants. You know, even though we have a mass of people here, there are still good people here. And it's still, we still want to operate on humanity sense. Like, I still consider myself a Christian first, a nationalist second. Not a Christian nationalist, but a Christian and a nationalist at the same time. I think it's important to identify that, because they're trying to use words. Like I said, you said they're changing definitions. Change definitions in the during the pandemic from adverse reactions to safe and effective. All of this change of language that they do to drip feed and propagandize. Or definitions.
Oh, yeah,
change of definitions.
Yeah.
Like inflation that is a good thing.
That was an amazing aspect of the whole COVID era, how things would get, the definitions would get changed. The one that springs to mind now, and I would have probably been able to reel off a whole list of them at the time, but yeah, the only one that springs to mind now is the definition of the word vaccine. Yeah. You know, that used to be a fairly straightforward thing. Everyone knew what it meant.
A small attenuated version of a live virus to now becoming becoming an mRNA digitized sequence version. That's what a vaccine actually is. They're trying to bring in the gene therapy.
and the effect of a vaccine, that used to be that, okay, I'm now immune to that disease, where that was changed as well. So a vaccine doesn't give you immunity. It just, I don't know, lowers your, not even your susceptibility. It gives you your body a defense against the disease. So you know, it's so crazy. And then, of course, as soon as the disease mutates, as it did by the season, the vaccine is obsolete. So you need an update. Hence the meme of Bill Gates with the time for your update. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, but it's grim and serious at the same time.
Because a huge swath of people buy into it and are swept up along it as well, because they're not invested in it. The likes of people like ourselves and other people are becoming more, they're not invested to understand it. And the government's there to run the things, to take care of us all. So why wouldn't I not believe them? You know what I mean? These are the people that spent years in institutions learning all this stuff. These are the professors. You're not a professor. You don't have the P's and Q's behind your name or the diplomas hanging on your wall, you know? So people just bought into authority.
Yes, very much. That was a sort of catch-all response you'd get from them. They would say, so are you a biologist? Are you a virologist? Are you an epidemiologist? Yeah. Well, no, I'm not, but I don't believe everything that those people say. And you know, it's not that difficult to find out about this stuff. It's not, you don't actually need 4 years of a degree or whatever, 8 years of a medical education in order to grasp this stuff. But so many people just wanted to defer to, and you know, it's human nature. Of course you're going to defer to experts, but you also need to have some common sense. You know, common sense needs to intervene on things, because otherwise the experts could be telling you utter rubbish. And I think in the case of COVID, a lot of the time they were. I mean, you know, not a lot of people died from it. That's the bottom line, is that it wasn't nearly as serious as everyone was led to believe at the start.
But that's all coming out now, though, isn't it? But there's been an American study now that's linking the vaccines to the rise in cancers and myocarditis. It's all coming out now, the stuff that we were saying, what we were censored for saying now. Now they're coming out and open admit it. Because they're going to sell you a cure to the problem they gave you in the first place. They're going to give you the stuff that you're going to need to keep the clotting down or to keep the adverse reactions down from whatever batch. Because as we understand, each batch was a different part of the experiment. That's the broadening range. And people didn't understand that the whole thing was a myriad of different experiments going on at different times and different locations, testing different results on different batches, because they would have had all that digitized. They knew exactly where each bottle was going, to where and what, and down to the point of who took it, what their blood type was, what their medical condition was. They knew it inside out. They were just experimenting to see which way would have the reactions. Or some people got the different manufacturers, obviously, and then different components that were inside that. We've got like the fifth column now, talking about the nanotechnology and different parts of it, or you know, the Bluetooth stuff and all of that. All of that fairly reasonable. You can get on board with it. Seen quantifiable, you know, pretty much evidence. But what I'm saying is now that they're admitting now to what we were talking about, and they're normalizing it now. Maybe it's true to I don't know. Are they going to bring it back now that they're going to try and scapegoat Fauci and put him on the world stage and just let Big Pharma walk away with another meaningless fine, but just hang him out to dry as the bad guy, and he was the whole reason all this happened, you know, and put it off.
I don't know, but he's a very old man. I think he's about 80 now, you know. But yeah, I don't expect any great punishment to be meted out to the people who, and you know, Pfizer, I'm pretty sure they knew in advance. I mean, there was one of their documents was released where they knew in advance that it was going to cause heart problems, their vaccine, but they released it anyway. Don't quote me on that. I'm just, you can do your own research. I'm pretty sure I read that about 6 months ago.
Failure. Every animal testing that they did on mRNA was a complete failure, and all subjects died with cancer and resulted of that. So they, and even when they're, during one of their speeches, they knew that the rates were going to come in after, because they, like I said, they have the answer to all the myocarditis. They have the cures to it. So they were expecting that, and putting in as part of the profit margin. And it wouldn't have been, what would you call that in a time of war? They used another phrase that they changed, collateral damage. They understood the amount of collateral damage, and they were going to profiteer off that as well. And because they have complete control of any entity that was supposed to, like the International Court, Criminal Courts, to bring up these cases, who's going to prosecute them? They have their own private armies, like BlackRock and all that now. They have PWCs that they can pay for. Nobody's going to challenge them. There's no, how do we smash up this monopoly of Big Pharma or the Rockefeller Big Pharma? It's so vast and huge. Just don't buy into their products and go for the natural alternatives and smoke, you know, support local businesses and stuff like that. I kind of going to want to go from the pandemic a little bit back to Ireland, a bit to the migration. But then also, again, as well, Colin, is the civilizational change, the demographic change in Europe. I've had many great fans. I did many great interviews with when I went back to Germany, to Stuttgart. I interviewed some of the people from AFD just before 2019, before that clashed down. I made some great contacts in Germany with AFD as well, to see that rise. To my good friends in Italy as well with the La Liga. You know, I was going out and traveling abroad, taking part in Pontida 2019 was the one I just did in Italy with the La Liga with Silvino, and before herself came in. Silvino was the big shark in the tank. He was going to take her position as the Prime Minister of Italy, because he was actually the one that was going to stop. If you remember, he took out the NGO pirate ship and stopped them during for the high seas. But then they brought charges up against him, you know, and according to them, I think they threatened his family as well. But all those nationalist movements are still there. I think of, I can't think of Martin's second name. All these great people like yourself that influenced me.
Martin Heller.
Martin Heller, yeah, no, I watch him, follow him on Twitter and stuff like that. Everybody that like of us that was lambasted and attacked, the vanguard at the start of him. We kind of comprehensively knew as the first adopters, there was going to be no material rise for us after the fact. Nobody remembers the first, it's the second. We created that pathway for those conversations that you and your guests, you know, these academic conversations and civilizational changes that were verboten. We're verboten. But you and the likes of and Keith and all these other people that are taking on, but yourself, you took all the heavy hits at the very start, because you were basing on the philosophies, and you were trying to have that academic discussion on the taboo subjects that were very taboo, and you got lambasted for that. I know that, and I took everything and every challenge with a pinch of salt. But I'm in my situation, you're in yours, and we're both heading in the same directory, you know. So, like I said, none of that was. I always looked at Millennial from afar, and all my good friends going on board. And, you know, we've good friends between us that we know as well. Why won't he bring me on? What did I ever do?
See, this is why I'm trying to migrate people, regular guests, to the banquets, so that I can have more. Because every year there are people that I want to have on, but there's not space, and it's become very annoying. But I do apologize. There was nothing about you that made me think, oh, I can't possibly have him on. It was nothing like that. At times I wasn't sure if you were still active, and then I got banned from YouTube, and I sort of fell away from YouTube. I stopped watching it, so I lost touch with things, and, you know, it was all Telegram, and so
it was quite cathartic as well, Colin. I think the separation from YouTube, it forced me to take that break, to sort of step back. I'd invested so much, like YouTube at that time. I was as a sparring journalist. We were getting funded by that, and I was able to manage myself. So I broke away from construction, which is my main gig. You know, I was able to break away from that and focus more on the citizen journalism. And it was funding me to be able to get around the country and bring the YouTube to certain situations. But then
there was a great period where you could make a living from YouTube, and I had a wonderful time doing that, and I felt like I was the luckiest. I thought I had the best job in the world. Yeah. But then from about 2018 onwards, definitely 2018 onwards, there was this constant threat of you could be banned, your channel could be shut down, could lose everything at any time. And in the meantime, they were throttling us. And I think that's still going on now on YouTube. So YouTube went from a sort of haven and a hotbed of this material to a ghost town, and then a lot of us were just banned from it completely. Mm. But for my point is that for several years before I was banned, it was a ghost town. It was sort of like there's no growth, you're not making a living from it. For a while, they were very successful, and people are still being banned from YouTube now. It happened just the other day, about 2 weeks ago, to Zoomer Historian. It's still happening. But what do you that, that's a whole thing in itself, that story of the censorship and the deplatforming that's happened. I think that Elon Musk buying Twitter was the turning point there.
Oh, yeah, the kitchen sink. What do you make of the reinstatement now of different accounts that have come back, like myself and stuff like that? Do you think that's part? I see it very much as a strategy, maybe as the pinpointing voices that they want to see as the nice in your situation over in Scotland or here in Ireland, the reinstatement of, because I didn't miss it. Like I said, part of it was cathartic. Then it forced me to look at going back into construction and focusing my efforts there and not relying on social media again to be the main part of my income and keeping the bread and butter stable. But I can't really devote that much time to doing citizen journalism. So it's back to streaming now and having those conversations. But there's loads of podcasts kicking off in Ireland, which is fantastic to see as well. There's a lot of people and they're broaching the subjects that were very much verboten, you know what I mean? And they would be high profile people.
Yeah, this is a thing where there's a new crop, a new generation of content creators on YouTube and elsewhere who have a slightly different way of approaching, like talking about these topics.
Michael McCarthy over here in Ireland, he's all around the world. You must have seen the way he does it is very fantastic.
Yeah, and perhaps they can get past the censors and it's a more, a different way of handling things. I mean, when I think about the way I used to talk about things in like 2015, 16, 17, it was just very matter of fact, very directly stating things. Whereas I think a lot of people nowadays avoid the banhammer by speaking in roundabout ways. And I've got nothing against that. I don't decry them for doing that. I think it's fine. It's perfectly legitimate. But it does slow down the conversation a bit. But still, the conversation's happening, and that's the important thing. I wonder if the corporations have to some extent given up on censorship, because I think the governments are now taking it over. I think for a long time the governments let the social media companies take care of this, but for whatever reason it became too obvious. I think some of them didn't feel comfortable with it because it gave them a bad reputation. So now you've got governments bringing in their own actual legislation, not corporate policy, actual governmental laws. And in Britain, it's the Online Safety Act. And there's something similar in America being cooked up. And in Australia, it's just come in. And I think the EU has just issued a directive that all its member states have to do this. And they say it's to protect kids. What do you think about that?
Well, in Europe, it's the Online Digital Safety Act, and it has many different tenants. We also have Commissioner Nahéireann here in Ireland, which was a media broadcasting czar, because all the social medias of Europe are mostly centralized here in Dublin, Facebook, Twitter, all the HQs are here, that the European Commission are using Commissioner Nahéireann, which is the propagandists over here, to regulate all the social media HQs. Hence, I'd say in Ireland or in the European sense, that fine that Elon Musk just recently got would probably originated from here, from Commissioner Nahéireann, would have brought that charges, and it's them giving Ursula von der Leyen and the rest of them the munitions to fire shot across the bow. But again, I think Ireland has been pretty central as part of that plan, because we, as you say, can make the legislative changes without any pushback, without any opposition. I think the whole of the Dáils, and the Dáils, I mean, each term of our parliaments have all been on board with WEF, or in some way have been estranged in with the Clergy plan, have been all been tied in. Like, we still had on the previous session of Parliament, the 33rd Dáil, we had Simon Coveney, who is the apprentice to Peter Sutherland. Peter Sutherland was the High Commissioner for Europe, who was one of the strongest advocates for Clergy plan, and he was the one that instigated about that. So they passed it down to different generations. And again, there's a whole line of timeline with the Coveneys and the different the different dynastic families that we have in power over here, that their fathers, their sons, their daughters get the seats, and they keep that that plan or that the replacement, not the theory, but they keep going. They know their part that they have to play and what they have to do, primarily to keep the funding going. They're giving early access to what they need to get ahead. Like, all the guards are landlords over here, so they're all making massive money off this slum landlordism. You know, part, as we said, of what was part of the bite for the pandemic, or I keep calling it that, as what it was once they knew, as they have done in this situation with the iPass and the migration centres, once they can get business latched onto it, once they can get business to suck on the teeth of what they see as free money for now to open up these iPass centres. We've got former county managers here making like 138 million off the different hotels that they've had and are buying into it. So once business sees a profit in it, then they buy into it. That's when the problem becomes worse and worse, as we did with the PPE equipment in the pandemic. Businesses knew that, oh, if I could get cheap stuff in from India or cheap stuff in from China, and I can make a vast profit on it, this is a great gig. This, oh, I can also claim my PPE now, free money for sitting on my ass. They're now getting taxed on that. They're now getting investigated for their audits, for their books, for the shipping. You know, that's all being come back to them. But the landlords especially, which I will say now, those that are signing their properties up to the government iPasses, I'd say deep down in the terms and conditions, you will lose that property because they will become the effective landlords of that property for you. So at the initial stage, once they know that businesses and landlords are buying into giving up their properties and that the state can legislate and bring in more and more rights in for landlords, that it'll get to a tipping point where that business enterprise will run off on its own and they'll take ownership of those properties and ouster all those landlords as well. You know, that's part of the drive to get business involved in it.
Nothing would surprise me. This is a good example of how when you're in control, you can make things happen that in such a way that it actually becomes self-sufficient. And so you can make it profitable for people to do what you want them to do. And so the government want landlords to give up. They want massive amounts of accommodation for foreign men. So they can set up this system whereby a company like Serco, for example, can make a huge profit from doing that. And it all comes out, it's paid for by the taxpayer. Or they can pay landlords and say to them, look, you have to worry from 1 year to the next about your tenants. We can give you a 10-year contract. For 10 years, you won't have to think about this. You won't have to worry about this. You won't have to pay for repairs to the house. We'll deal with everything. And a lot of landlords will just think that sounds fantastic. And then, of course, it's the same with hotel owners, hoteliers. I've seen bulk contracts where the entire hotel is just taken over by whether it's the government directly or through an intermediary like Serco. An entire hotel is just taken over, and then the hotelier doesn't need to worry about, you know, the quiet season or advertising or keeping the place spruce. Nothing. All of his worries are just taken off his shoulders, and he's given a massive wad of cash in return. You can see how a lot of people would go along with that. A lot of people would say yes to that, even though it's, you know, massively treacherous to their co-ethnics.
Yeah. Well, as Crazy Fox says, every guy has a price. You know, they bank on people's greed, that will further on and drive the plan on a little bit further. You know, as an author.
Yeah.
So, I think that's very much the case here now. But the largesse now, I kind of bring it back to the European thing as well now with the current situation of, say, like the war now with Russia just openly spanking Ukraine and NATO up and down the park. That NATO are doubling down now to have this war, which I think they inevitably want. They're escalating all the time. Hence why the large influx of single males at the time, because I think they're going to strive for war with Russia on any front. Or what the UK are trying to do, are going to try and put boots on the ground in Ukraine and frame it as peacekeepers. And Russia's not going to have that. But I think we do also think that the first row, if the first wave of conscriptions will be white kids and Irish kids and British kids off of the front lines. They'll have these drongos here patrolling the streets of the civvies that will be left behind, and they'll be in charge of the army or patrolling the streets in wartime. because we seem to be escalating now. What Europe is doing now is creating emergency legislation now to confiscate, as the Duran says, confiscate the frozen assets, Russia's frozen assets. They're stealing money so that they can leverage it to go onto the markets again to try and drive more money so that they can create this rearming of Europe, this new super army that all the bots on X are trying to push out. We're proud to be European and we will defend it to our last breath. I said, all these AI bots coming out. No Irishman will sign up for any of that nonsense. And I think my main focus for next year, my new broadcasting since I come back now, is I am going to try and focus my attention on those younger generations. Because of my work, I come in contact with apprentices that are coming in and out there for different trades and stuff like that. And they're becoming more and more. Some of them are blankly obscure to it. And they just go, I can't afford my car. Can't know where I need to leave. I don't know why this is happening. What do I need? They don't see. I can't afford to go on the weekend. Their area of focus is tiny and to the immediacy of when's my next point and when's the next weekend coming in. Because that's how it should have been when you're at that age. You shouldn't have to, you know, become the maturity and have to think about, well, we have to build up a European resistance force that we can go start up a new crusade and fight back against the new Saladinian incursion, the Islamic invasion again.
Yeah. Well, if only. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember when young adults could think like that, whereas now it's a very different scenario, very different thing that people are growing up into. Definitely not the Ireland that you knew in the 80s and 90s.
We've lost track of that demographic change, but you're right. But I do, sorry, just to cut across again. I do think, though, that the Alphas and the Zoomers, I do think there's hope for us as well. We have to maintain, keep doing what we kind of do. But I think the Fuentes, the Groypers, all of that situation will pay dividends when they assume the ascendancy into power when it's their turn to take over.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that since we've got to that point in the chronology. It seems to me that young adults, Zoomers, people in their teens and 20s, have emerged into a world where, you know, for you and me, like, I guess you've sort of reached adulthood around 1990, I was 10 years later. And at that point, the world was still roughly as you had been told it was. Things still made sense, mostly. And you could, you know, get a job, get a mortgage, find a wife, have a family, etc. It was still very possible to do that. I think the Zoomers are the first generation for whom the advert does not match the reality. You know, and what they find when they reach adulthood is that they are, it's a very different situation from what they've been told. And it's a very different, and the advice that they get from their elders just is not relevant. It's just not applicable. It doesn't work. And I think, well, therefore, it's no surprise that a lot of them seem to be, well, it seems to be bifurcating. So the women are massively left-wing, extremely left-wing, and the men are in the opposite direction. What are your perceptions about the Zoomer question?
Sorry, the Zoomer question. I only recently heard bifurcation there in relation to AI. PewDiePie was building a bigger system and he was bifurcating his RAM. You'd see the price of electronics going through the roof. Sorry. The separation of the sexes, was that the question there? The separation
between we don't need to talk about that. I'm polarizing between the sexes, but that's not relevant. What I want to ask is, why do you think that so many young adults, Zoomers and Gen Alpha, are so pissed off and so much more amenable to this stuff than, say, people of our age?
Well, they have grown up firsthand with an iPad in their hand. They've been babysat, well, not like the millennials to that extent, but they're of that age of information. They're leaps and bounds ahead of us in maturity and understanding at an earlier age, because education is far more sophisticated. Educational options are far more sophisticated. Homeschooling is far more sophisticated. But they're born into a world of chaos. And with everything becoming online, all the different cultures of online, the online gaming and all the different things, they have access to information that they're able to determine. But they see the push out because of the invasion of DEI and all of that other stuff into the games. The one place where they wanted to retreat and just invest their imaginations into gameplay and role play online, when they seen the DEI creeping in there into gamers and taking over their leisure time, that they were forced to break out and say, what is this craziness of like the gaming journalists that don't actually play games, that don't actually like games, and are just shooting it down and are just rolling in storylines just to fit the different collage and spectrum of, like, when I just seen the latest Call of Duty breakout, and one of the skins was some dude in a wheelchair flying through the air. The inclusion of nonsense that has just invaded them. They cannot just sit down and simply enjoy the games that he wants. But there's an economic drive in all of that as well. They're more affluent now as well, because they're not, maybe they've seen, they don't have to go to college. They just have to create an app, or they just have to have the next big idea. They can have big money. They understand that they, like, I've heard stories now of people making $10 million a month just on creating, the arenas inside Call of Duty, or maps, different maps. There's a whole, they're making millions, they're making hundreds of thousands, but they will have the economic power behind themselves, and they are engaged now, like the Groypers are engaged, that they will fund themselves, and they will actively keep their power levels low, as is suggested by Nick, so that they can get into the roles of academia and they can turn things around. So I think that there's an area of responsibility on them to save Western civilization, because it's either that or be slowly subsumed by the Islamic infestation and just suffer at the hands of groups of people on the individual, or come together as a group and create that resistance group and fund that Christians group. And those outlaws, not those outlaws, but those main voices like the Fuentes and the different peoples of their generation that speak out, like the young Bob, who come out now that are very well articulated, very well versed in historical events and all manner of things that I would not have had the first clue till I became an older person and came in contact with it now. So they're very well equipped. So they recognize that they don't want to own nothing and not be happy and be happy owning nothing. They want what their parents were told, that the boomer said, you could have all of this on one income, and you could have that family life. And then they seen that the disaster, what the millennials followed, was drowning themselves in debt, not being able to get a qualification that was representative in the marketplace, that was actually wanted in the marketplace. And like the EV battery situation or anything that's funded by government, the inclusion of DEI, it's coming to its spiral or its full circle now, where it's in America now, it's being chucked off the side. So there's a whole... I think that'll spread down as well. I think America's withdrawal from Europe will be a good thing for us. It'll be painful, but it's necessary and something that should have happened years ago, and that would help nation states recoup their own standing on their own two feet with their own armies, and maybe go back to that cooperation of states, not this united Russian states of Europe now with the van der Leyen and the unelected bureaucracy, which I think we're going to have either a soft coup or some sort of revolution to resolve that. And again, not all revolutions are bloody, like the French and stuff like that, but just mass non-compliance on a large scale, like Bulgaria did, just ousted their thing, because their whole country was unified, as they were in the pandemic, when they were the biggest country to say no to the injections and not take any of it. And now they just ousted their government because they stood firm as a group outside. Sorry, Colin, go ahead.
I don't know if I answered the question, Colin.
I don't know if I answered the question per se.
No, no.
I think they're born into that area where they have to assume that responsibility to get themselves out of that situation. They're going to have to overcome all of this as well.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, there are a couple of super chats. There's one from Ivor, which I can't possibly read out, but he's just wishing us good luck. And then there's one from Ulrich. And he asks, is Conor McGregor still talking about running for president? Is he taken seriously in Ireland?
I'm not going to besmirch Conor in any way, shape or form, because I think what he did by going up on the world stage and saying and highlighting our situation came possibly as a great financial cause to himself. But he put us on the map and he drew the world's attention to us. Now, all the stuff previous and his timeline, his thing, that's his storyline. We all grew up, Conor. Some of us love him, some of us don't. He was a big, important, another important reason for me that I went back to martial arts. I got back into jiu-jitsu I love the whole MMA scene. And I love Conor's braggadociousness when he first came out on the scene. And, you know, it's my island. We loved that. It was the self-confidence. And that's what the Zoomers and the Millennials are, not that they desperately seek it, but if they can't find it elsewhere, they'll find it in themselves, is that character that, for all his flaws that Conor had, he was the specimen. He's the fighter. He loves his country. He's coming out and speaking. And like many detractors in chats and stuff like that saying, you know, the rape charges and all that kind of different stuff that goes on. Setting that aside, may not totally agree with the messenger, but the message was on point, and it was critical that he did what he did at that time. And he set the cat among the pigeons by announcing that he'd run for the presidency. And I think to not take Conor seriously in any way, shape or form, given his reputation, given his contacts and his wealth, the great damage he could do to the state if him and other well-to-do people were to establish and fund a party, an oppositional party, and invest people of high calibre and pay people of high calibre. Our own barristers that we have here and solicitors and the elites of our class and the nationalist side, that we could form that AFD. Ireland desperately needs an opposition of some party. Now, a lot of you will say, well, politics, you know, we're not going to get this by the political movement. Possibly not. I still think it's a revolution. Soft dictatorship or a soft coup. Any one of the above would do me. But if we are going to play the game, then we have at least got to give the 60% or the floating, the gateposters, you have to give them something to draw them towards, like the Zoomers and the Alphas, the voter block of people. What is our strategy for gaining that sovereignty? What can we expect on an economic front? How can we maintain? Are we worried about the Trump's tariff charges, removing big pharma from our economies, which I think we need, because we're awash in money, corporation tax. We're pulling in, I just found out there, $10 billion a month in corporation tax. And that is only a small fraction of what the taxation should be, but it's enough to keep the plebs happy that we're now, you know, on an average year, we're bringing in $120 million. For a population of 6 and 7 million, our NHS bill is $26 billion a year. You know, our welfare system is now superseded. That's $28-30 billion a year. Now, so most of our corporation tax is funding that government system. So when Trump does say we're going to put up 200% tariff on pharmaceutical goods, and I know, I guarantee you, they've already got their pharma sites in America already up and running, only waiting for the day that they will just drop operations over here, and a great swath of our middle class are invested in that, and they will be dropped like fleas, just gone. We are not. We. They will take the 15% corporation tax that he will match, that Ireland has, because Ireland also is one of the epicenters for dark money and dark banking. That's why there's a huge waft of money that seems to go through Ireland, but it never finds its way into the ground of infrastructure. You know, roads, new road systems, that has all been left on the shelf to depreciate and to fall apart, to bring in that chaos, to overwhelm the system so that they can bring in the new system, obviously.
Yeah. Well, that's as I was saying earlier, there's so much money sloshing around and yet fundamental things seem to get neglected. And it's a weird aspect of this age we're living in. There's one more question. This comes from Armchair Limerick Nationalist. He says, Merry Christmas, Woes and Gran Torino. Does Rowan think that the Irish government will enforce conscription if things escalate with the conflict in Ukraine?
Brings us back to what I said earlier on about the firm belief that they will. At the moment, they're trying to destroy what we have in place called the triple lock, which is a system in place that we cannot designate by ourselves. We need a third party to agree to unlock our neutrality. The triple lock locks us into remaining neutral in all situations. That's why we said we should have been the great negotiators between the Ukraine and the Russia and a place like Switzerland or a place to avail where they came. But we're so overrun with traitors, WEF, WHO, a whole crowd, just a complete place for a banana republic. They will try to remove our triple lock, which will make us able then to send peacekeepers afford. And then they think they will bring in conscription. I 100% believe. I know Germany have already started that process, trying to bring in the German army. I know that the British military force is completely underspent and has been left to deteriorate. Now all of a sudden they want to switch it back on. But even as such, Millennial, even if they do, it's still going to take 10 years They're talking about trying to have a war with Russia by 2030. We've no factories to build munitions. We've no, no, logistically, we cannot even leave our own islands. So all they have is to remove boots on the ground and fly them over to Ukraine to take over whatever military logistics is over there. And as I said, the first wave will be the indigenous populations to remove them and to fight the Russian bear. I know no nationalist, in my heart of soul, thinks ill of Russia, the one and only sovereign nation, the one and only, as I understand it, has its own central bank and doesn't have the globalist central bank. And we know where every war is a banker war. But yeah, I definitely do think they're going to try for conscription. They're already talking about they've just bought new anti-drone. But that just reminds me there as well. Zelensky just travelled over to Dublin and his plane was supposed to be being followed on his way out by four drones. The government announced that four drones had been approaching Zelensky's. It's part of the narrative drop in to try and keep the scary Russians, the bad Russians are acting. But in some strange schism now, the press are actually saying, well, why wasn't air traffic control notified that there was four drones in the air? Why weren't the pilots notified? So politicians have been trying to stream this narrative and have been caught out. And it seems that the media have had to come up and say, well, all the normal procedures that would have taken place had such an incursion taken place over the national airport, that all of these lockdowns would have come in place and none of that happened. So why are you coming out with this nebulous, scary Russian story so that they can continue on with their spending on their military spending of anti-drone technology, which is to take down, I'd say, the civilians' drones that we use, that I used in my early productions to fly over protests so that we would have an aerial viewscape of our numbers because everybody was down in the crowds and it was hard to get that. So I used to fly my drone outside the custom house and we'd see that as they started off in the early days, would barely be the width of the custom house building to reaching now beyond the streets and coming around itself. The numbers have increased over a period of time, but it's that spectrum. But they're going to try and ground those. They tried to do it with the European Drone Digital Act, that you had to have a license and you couldn't fly a drone over a certain weight. But luckily we have the River Liffey flying up to the river, the middle of the city. So you can fly your drone over water, no problem, you know, and I could fly it straight up the middle of the city and do aerial escapes. But they're weaponizing themselves. But I'm informed that we don't have the factories to create munitions. We don't have the factories to create tanks. These things take a hell of a lot of time to re-engage. Hence where they're trying to leverage this frozen asset money to bring up this 1.3 trillion rearming of Europe fund that they're going to take. It's just a slosh fund for Van der Leyen and the rest of them to, as Zelensky did, is splash the money everywhere and nothing will actually come of it. But they will send our sons and daughters to a war that knowing that they will die, that they have a population in place already and available to take over as it is now taking their places now. And because of the excess debts and our population is dying off, there's not one of us over here that doesn't have one or two or three friends that are constantly getting sick. Constantly, people are dying left, right, and center. I've lost two great friends over our travels here as well through cancer and various other things. And people are dying and they're being replaced unnoticed because it's, you know, it's just, well, excess debts. Nobody's talking about it. And we're not going to back talk about the injections or why everybody's immune system is compromised and all that kind of stuff. So I think
a lot of people just want to forget about COVID now because it's too painful.
But they got troops.
Yeah. But anyway, we're going to have to wrap this up now because I've got the next guest on in 18 minutes. But this has been a really interesting conversation, Rowan, and I'm very glad that we've finally done it. I apologize again that it took so long.
Don't say that. Not at all.
Yeah. Is there anything that you'd like to say just to wrap up before we finish?
I don't have any wise, you know, philosophical musings and all of that. I would just encourage each and everyone to mind our mental health, inform as many people around, particularly the youth, have a word in their ear, the younger men and the younger women. And just express your knowledge to them, but just protect your mental health, keep going forward. And as a Christian, just keep speaking the truth and don't let them force you to, what do they say, hold two different truths, but to express the lies and believe in the lies, even though you know it's a lie and that it's wrong. Don't let them trick you into that 1984 situation where we have to try and comply to get ourselves, stand forthright, and whatever happens, happens, you know what I mean? That's all I can say to that. But thank you very much for your, for the invitation. It was a big honor. It is a big honor to be on Millennial Yule. And I appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting conversation. We've touched on many different things, and it's been in roughly chronological order as well. So it's been very interesting. All right. Thank you very much. I'll be back soon with The Black Horse. And in the meantime, Rowan Croft, Gran Torino, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.